Hi, and welcome to episode 15 of the Unpacking Weight Science podcast called When is a Diet Not a Diet? Health at Every Size, Intuitive Eating and Medical Nutrition Therapy. I'm your host, Fiona Willer, weight neutral professional development dietitian, academic and size acceptance advocate. Dietitians and nutrition professionals can feel like the nutrition baby is being thrown out with the diet bathwater when learning about the non-diet approach, health at every size and intuitive eating. Many wonder, if I can't tell people what to eat, what's left? Is there any point to dietitians? Do I just forget all my medical nutrition therapy knowledge? This existential crisis is a consequence of nutrition-related professions identifying with their key expertise being in weight management. This episode sorts the therapeutic wheat from the fatphobic chaff to offer an alternative perspective on your professional identity. Our learning goals today are to recognise the different meanings of the terms diet and dietary pattern and their common and technical uses, to identify the therapeutic nutrition elements in Health at Every Size, Intuitive Eating and the Non-Diet Approach frameworks and their centering around feel-good eating, and to differentiate between internal versus external motivation and their application in weight neutral practice. Firstly, I want to tell you a bit about dietetic practice. We go to university and learn anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, metabolism, pathophysiology, food science, human behavior theory, counseling skills, public and community health principles, and food service. But the crowning glory of our skill set and the one that sets us apart from other nutrition graduates is the training in medical nutrition therapy. So that's basically knowledge of ways of eating that have been shown to reduce mortality and morbidity, particularly in an acute setting like a hospital. So tube feeds for people who can't eat, vein feeds for people who can't use their gastrointestinal tract, soft foods for people who can't chew, and diets that provide the nutrition that somebody needs to survive their medical condition. Medical nutrition therapy is driven by evidence and the scientific method. So conclusions come from averages of responses to set regimes by people with the same condition. Of course, there's variation at an individual level here too. So people who have underfunctioning kidneys or kidney failure, for example, need to adjust their dietary pattern and nutrient intake to avoid a buildup of the body's waste products that the kidneys usually siphon out through urine. This sort of dietary change is life-saving for that individual. And there are similarly life-sustaining therapeutic diets for people with liver failure, cystic fibrosis, people undergoing chemotherapy, people recovering from physical trauma, surgery, recovering from malnutrition, etc. You can think about these dietary patterns specifically for serious illness and recovery. They have virtually no use for the regular non-ill human. A diet that keeps a very unwell person alive is not going to make a relatively well person more alive. These diets have been developed over a long time and tested in decent clinical trials in hospital settings, that is, in very controlled environments for the recipient of the diet, as well as the nutrient composition of the food provided, well controlled everywhere. If, like in the case of kidney dialysis, most people live at home and come in a few times a week for dialysis, they're still well engaged with the health service and are highly motivated to eat in a way that reduces their chance of immediate death. These kind of diets, therapeutic ones, are the most well supported in the scientific literature. Despite only being for clinical use, it's common to hear regular people criticise the types of foods their relatives received in hospital for not being healthy enough. Well, hospital's not a health spa. We're trying to get you out of there alive, and in the world of food, that means that the most nutrition in a small volume of food is more life-saving than plates laden with salad. The next kind of dietary pattern advice that's given by dietitians and properly qualified nutritionists is to reduce the risk of recurrence of future disease or life-limiting event, like a stroke or a heart attack, or like diabetes-related complications. And the evidence here is based on observational studies. That is, dietary patterns are observed along with these life-limiting events or surrogate markers of disease, and then the dietary pattern advice is reverse engineered. For example, the process goes something like, oh, this population eats a lot of purple berries and also doesn't have as many heart attacks as this other population. Let's trial purple berries with people to see if it impacts on their cardiovascular risk factors. Oh, look, it does have a bit of an impact. Okay, so now we recommend that everyone eat purple berries to reduce their risk of heart attack. Meanwhile, the original population differed in a multitude of other ways from the reference population, and the people who trialled the purple berries in that study were healthier than the general population. And although their risk factor markers decreased, they may well have ended up having the same or greater heart attacks as the reference population, but weren't still being followed, so we never find this out. Meanwhile, purple berries have made a lot of people a lot of money for very little actual benefit to the population and the possibility of harm. Doing things this way, by using observations to make recommendations without testing the recommendations properly in the middle, or properly first, divorces the dietary pattern from its real-world context. Repeat, we don't know if it even works to reduce disease or life-limiting event unless it's trialled in a long-term lifestyle intervention trial. A major flaw with the few of these that have been done is that, as usual, it's the people who already benefit from fairly good health prospects due to other factors that sign up for these studies. Those who don't have enough agency, time, or resources to participate simply don't, even though they're the ones overrepresented in the disease incidence and prevalence stats. And this is why governments leaning on the personal responsibility narrative is BS. The only way to improve the health of a nation, in as much as food may be able to, is to ensure that everyone has the same access to nourishing, health-supporting foods and a cultural environment of enjoying food variety. The two kinds of more prescriptive dietary patterns I've spoken about already, medical nutrition therapy and dietary patterns for chronic disease risk reduction and management, are not necessarily weight-centric. People in smaller bodies need medical nutrition therapy, and people in smaller bodies are also usually pretty keen to avoid future chronic disease or manage any conditions that they have. So we can think of these as dietary patterns consistent with supporting clinical outcomes and preventative health. But unfortunately, because it's been assumed that a lower body weight is a direct reflection of eating well, the guidelines make the claim that eating this way will reduce your weight if your body's larger, or will make sure that you don't gain weight if your body's currently smaller. But the difference in proportion of the people in larger bodies who eat well compared with the people in smaller bodies who eat well is in the 1-2% range. That's 1-2%. And eating well only mitigates weight creep over time in a very small proportion of people. It's by no means a guarantee. One of the first things covered when you start to learn about health at every size, intuitive eating, and the non-diet approach is that while dietitians may officially take the meaning of diet in its original sense, that is, it just means the things that we eat, the term diet has been co-opted by the weight loss industry. What used to be called following a weight-reducing diet is now just referred to widely as going on a diet or dieting. And it's that kind of use of the word diet that's the problem. How can you tell if a dietary pattern or way of eating is the kind of diet that's inappropriate in Hay's practice? If the goal explicitly or implicitly is weight reduction or weight control, then it's a diet. It's weight-centric, no matter how beautifully designed or delicious it is. And where there is temporary weight loss or effortful weight suppression, there's likely to be eventual weight regain. Health at every size, intuitive eating, and the non-diet approach call to shift the purpose of dietary pattern changes from weight control to the goals of nourishment, enjoyment, social connection, body function, health enhancement, and feeling good. Weight change may or may not happen, but it's not the purpose of the changes, and so is not a primary outcome measure. Hay's is not anti-weight loss or anti-weight change, it's anti-pursuit of weight loss or weight change, and it's anti-celebration of weight loss or weight change. We've seen too many people be celebrated for their cancer-related weight loss, and too many people lamenting how hideous it feels to go back to a health provider who had celebrated their weight loss that has subsequently been regained. In a weight-centric paradigm, weight loss diets are presented as therapeutic, a type of chronic disease risk reduction diet, and at times a chronic disease management tool. Weight loss diets can only be considered therapeutic if two weight-centric assumptions are in play. A, that being a higher weight is a bad thing, and B, that shrinking a body to a lower weight will avoid the higher weight bad thing. Both of these assertions are not necessarily correct, of course. Without the weight centrism, weight loss diets cannot and are not considered therapeutic. For anyone in a smaller body who's unwell, prescribing weight loss would be considered malpractice. unintentional weight loss or easy weight loss if somebody is on a diet are huge red flags that something is not right with that person. They may very well be harboring an as yet undetected cancer. This weight change is a vital sign and should not be ignored. Any clinician worth their salt would confirm the deep dread they feel when someone reports recent unintentional weight loss. And we need to stop dismissing that gut feeling when someone reports intentional weight loss as well. Intermittent fasting, meal replacement products, Weight Watchers, calorie counting, low carb, high fat, all exist because of weight centrism. They have no examples of their widespread use in a living population with cultural and social embeddedness. Instead, they're the inbred offspring of diet culture itself. They claim effectiveness primarily because of the effect of the diet on weight or weight control, and almost always only in the short-term studies that don't follow people past that honeymoon weight loss phase. The secondary outcomes they claim tend to be the effects of energy restriction, that is the suppression of biochemical measures, another surrogate marker, rather than reduction in absolute risk of a real clinical endpoint like a stroke or a heart attack. We have a problem in dietary pattern research when weight loss and weight loss maintenance is presumed and assumed to be a good thing. We have no such evidence that links weight loss maintenance with reliable increases in longevity, independent of the behaviours and metabolic circumstances that are influencing that weight suppression. To draw that bow at the moment is simply wishful thinking. To put that another way, if someone who has lost weight and kept it off, so a statistical outlier already, does live a longer than average lifespan, we don't know if it's common or garden variety luck, genetics, the daily walk that they did before and after their weight loss, their penchant for tropical fruits, their strong community ties and supportive personal relationships, their wealth, their avoidance of particular infectious childhood diseases, their mother's growth in utero in their grandmother. I mean, there are thousands of factors to control for before we can say for sure that it was the weight loss that was doing the thing. And yet that mistake is made again and again. You'll see in the research papers that I've linked to in the supporting materials that they make this mistake too, which is why we have to read this stuff really carefully and look for the evidence of benefits and risks of health-related behaviours independent of weight change. For example, have vegetables found to be good for body function and reducing the risk of chronic disease in studies of stable weight people? Or observational studies where everyone is doing their normal life stuff without a formal lifestyle intervention? What other things is vegetable intake related to in regular populations? Could it be that those things are having an impact too, even though our present research question is desperately seeking evidence of the benefits of vegetables? Now, I'm not saying vegetables don't have benefits. I think they probably do have real benefits, but the trouble is unpacking all of that stuff. And finally, there are dietary patterns which I classify as philosophical or identity diets. Things like paleo, veganism, even low carb because of their promotion by guru types that have their nutritional upsides and downsides, but which were developed from a philosophical position rather than being driven by careful observation of populations and health in the real world. Low carb diets can be useful for people who have the tendency towards dangerously high blood sugar levels, but for everyone who has a working pancreas and a rapid blood sugar response, there's no biological reason to cut out carbs. It's another case of treat specific medical condition diet being assumed to also be make healthier even if I'm not sick diet. So these kind of diets serve moral, social, or religious purposes rather than health goals, although they may be positioned by the people promoting them as a gateway to health, or indeed, as is usual, avoidance of death, like immortality and prey on our fear of our own demise. It's a big purchasing push. Some have actually been studied for their health benefits, but many haven't, and many rely on the belief of goodness and influencer endorsement rather than outcomes. Philosophical or identity diets may serve some people well spiritually, but do a number on their wallet, their physical health, and their connections with the people that they value. I have no problem with adults who have enough time, energy, and money to eat however the heck they want. And if eating this way has meaning for them, then great. But they have no place pushing their dogma on others. A health at every size or intuitive eating practitioner is by definition non-denominational when it comes to philosophical or identity diets. We would ask some questions like, how is the way you're choosing to eat serving you right now? How would you know when it's no longer working out for you? What would you look for? Just like in medicine, eating clinicians tend to value outcomes that they can see or measure directly, like blood pressure or biochem or weight. And these measures don't depend on the client reporting them, they're objective, and we're taught to value objectivity above all else in medicine. However, this prioritising of objective measures is not how most patients measure things. They tend to want to feel good or feel better and don't necessarily give a hoot what some blood test says since they can't feel that anyway. There have been studies that have looked at the physician-patient relationship and asked the physician what they wanted for the client and what they thought the client wanted, and then asked the client what they wanted and what they thought the physician wanted for them, and there's this huge divide. Patients tend to want to feel better so they can get on with things, even if that potentially means shortening their lifespan, while physicians assumed that the patients wanted the same things they wanted for them, and that is a longer life at any cost. Unless we catch ourselves, we project our own fears and values all over our clients. And coming back to our main theme today, that of what is the place of the therapeutic diet in health at every size, intuitive eating, and the non-diet approach, you can see quite clearly that the therapeutic hospital-based diets are more about avoiding malnutrition and sudden death. Medical nutrition therapy in these cases should be tailored for the individual, and particularly for somebody with a larger body, we need to ensure that we're actively trying to avoid adding malnutrition to their list of woes. Weight loss via hypermetabolic processes due to illness and lower appetite is well known to be deleterious in smaller people, but a blind eye is turned to similar effects in larger people. Yes, they have some body stores, but that does not give you the right to plunder their adipose tissue because we have this unfounded belief that shrinking a larger body is inherently a good thing. So adjust their tube feeds to feed the body that they have. Aim for weight maintenance, just like you do with smaller body people. Weight loss in the hospital because you've been underfed on purpose because you have a fatphobic medical specialist is not a good thing. Dietitians, advocate for your patients to not be starved, please. And then we have the risk reduction dietary patterns. What recommendations would we be making if the person had a BMI of 22? Do I have any good reason why that advice is not appropriate for somebody in a larger body? What evidence is it actually based on? Be critical of that evidence. Finally, the feel-good dietary pattern is the goal of all dietary counselling. Feel-good eating is an eating style which results in a comfortable physical body experience and a perspective of food, eating, and body that enhances mental health rather than acts as a burden. Sometimes this is achieved with patterns consistent with medical nutrition therapy or philosophical diets, but more often individuals need to tweak things to work towards it. In Health at Every Size and Intuitive Eating, this process is led curiously by the person with the body rather than as a regimen being prescribed by the clinician. Health at Every Size asks us to help people broaden their concept of health away from over-reliance of using body weight as an indication of health to consider other aspects of health feedback, and that includes physical and mental aspects. The goal is to imbue people with a curiosity about food and enthusiasm for trying new foods and food combinations, as well as eating what they enjoy and what feels good, keeping an open mind about what works and what doesn't work for them right now. It encourages body and health literacy and paying attention to the feedback the body sends, and that includes biochemical markers. Because if and when things start to go not so well, the ideal outcome is for the person to recognise that themselves and change things around. You want them to not need you unless they've got questions about what scientific evidence says about a food-disease relationship. For example, if someone follows their body cues and taste buds to a dietary pattern that looks pretty similar to what is dictated in an identity diet, I have no problem with that. The problematic element is that these diets are prescribed A, for weight loss, which is a shonky reason to begin with, and B, as if they're much more evidence-based than they actually are. There's no guarantee that you'll feel good on them, and even less guarantee that your mental and or physical health will be supported. I can't discuss the feel-good dietary pattern without acknowledging the incredibly corrosive and toxic impact of internalized weight stigma. When a person has deeply internalized weight stigma, it feels like the rest of the world is consistent with their worldview. The thinking goes, society hates larger bodies, I hate my larger body, it feels right, or at least consistent. When people begin a weight loss diet or once they've started losing weight, they feel fabulous, in part because it feels like they're on a train out of weight stigmaville, a train out of internalized weight stigma and societal weight stigma. I've been on that train. It's a marvelous drug, but it's short-lived. It's an anticipatory pleasure for many, heightened by the cognitive impacts of energy restriction, entrenched by seeing the numbers on the scale decrease with effort. But as soon as the weight inevitably comes back, or if they didn't believe that they deserved to live without stigma, you know, the weight loss surgery client who's ended up significantly lower weight but who still says they still feel fat inside, or the spoiled identity stuff. The kicker is that the train is an illusion, and internalized weight stigma does not go away until you've done the work. It's like Groundhog Day. So in summary, being a HAZE, intuitive eating or non-diet approach dietitian means being able to contextualize the evidence to the individual circumstances. And at the core of that skill is being able to communicate uncertainty, sublimating a dietary pattern from observational research findings to a prescription for an individual must necessarily come with a long list of caveats and limitations. When we start instead at an individual and prompt experimentation with different ways of eating, with curiosity to settle or manage uncomfortable physical symptoms, to perhaps have a go at seeing if dietary changes manipulates their biochemical risk factors, because the proclivity for dietary pattern changes to do this is very variable, with much less predictable than the impact of energy restriction on blood fats and blood sugar. So we want the client to be able to say, I know how my body works. I listen to my body's cues. I observe the impact that the way I eat has on my relationships and my mental and physical health. And I'm committed to working with my body through food and eating to make my experience of this life personally valuable. You can see the dietitian or nutrition advisor is peripheral to these outcomes. My final word of advice to people who talk to other people about food and eating for a living. Specialization is great, but my recommendation is to specialize in a condition rather than in a particular type of dietary pattern. Diets will come and go. If you've pegged your professional identity on a particular kind of diet, you and your skills may go down the drain when it does. And you're also at risk of seeing your favorite diet as a way to fix multiple conditions, when all you have is a hammer, all you ever see is nails. And we've fallen into this trap with weight loss diets. Focus on management of a particular health condition means that your drive will be to continue to learn deeply about the condition and be on the lookout for factors that might be helpful for your clients. If your focus is on a type of dietary pattern instead, then you'll be at risk of both confirmation bias and sunk cost bias, neither of which makes for an effective clinician. So that's it for this episode. The supporting materials, which include the show notes, research links, and self-test quiz, are available upfront for current subscribers, only $5 a month, which is a bargain, or can be purchased in a bundle if you're catching up later. See unpackingweightscience.com for details. And next time, episode 15 is Dietary Quality, Measurement, Magnitude, and Meaning. In recent years, nutrition research has moved from a focus on nutrients to a focus on foods and eating patterns. Dietary quality broadly refers to the variety of foods in somebody's usual eating habits. In this episode, I'll be bringing you up to date with the current state of play with this kind of research, how impactful dietary quality is on health outcomes, and how you can use it and measure it in your practice. So until next time, goodbye. We'll be right back.